This is KOWSLP, Occidental 92.5 FM, serving Santa Rosa and West Sonoma County for 18 years. Streaming to the world at KOSFM.com from our studios in Santa Rosa. You can visit our website to listen, donate, or volunteer. You can also download the Radio Rethink streaming app from the App Store. Our email address is kows@sonic.net. You can give us a like on Facebook at facebook.com/kows.fm. Also, attention, local businesses. Your business can be mentioned 5 or more times a week on air by our hosts. For as little as $1 a day, you too can become an underwriter. Email us at kows@sonic.net.
Trees have fingers that they steal the eyes from me. Why may I not go play out in the barn? Barn hand may take you and drown you in the tarn.
Listening to The Mountain, an Adoration in a Multitude of Parts. And I'm your host, Andrew Lewis. If you're joining us for the first time, you'll be listening to a serialized story playing the second and fourth Friday of every month on KOWS 92.5 in the Haven of Occidental. For the duration of our time together, I'll be telling you about a walk I took in the 1990s and about some statues and prints in a small chapel in Southern California. If it sounds slight, trust me, others have made far more out of lesser grist. And if you're just diving in and are needing to get up to speed, I strongly recommend you listen to the preceding episodes, which can be found on the Mountain page at the KOWS website. And the usual trigger warnings, I won't repeat them. You can imagine what they are. With that, let's get started. I left you a few weeks ago with my mother beating my brother on the kitchen floor. At about that time, my future wife, Anna, and a guy by the name of John Broccoli were meeting for the very first time. Anna's family of eight had just moved from Houston to San Diego. Her dad was a radio guy, a morning drive time talk show host who'd been hired on in San Diego, and he'd bought a large rambling craftsman perched on the lip of a canyon in the neighborhood of Mission Hills. Soon after they arrived, a 12-year-old Anna and her older sister Jenny were exploring the neighborhood. A few blocks away on a corner, they saw this gangly kid. Jenny, red-haired and freckled and sassy, rode up on a bike. She was playful and smart-alecky, and she had this Texas drawl. "You got any candy corn?" Jenny had asked. They all became friends. Anna's mother, Barbara, was bright and endearing and welcomed all the kids who came over. A year later, Barbara died. Forlorn and betrayed, she'd hung herself in her bedroom. Her note was simple. "The ball is now in your court," she said. Early the next morning, a friend, 15-year-old Julie Parrott, stood on John's porch, and she was crying. "Barbara killed herself," she said. Word spread quickly, and it was like a cloud fell over the neighborhood that summer. John would later recall how Anna and her five siblings had all become broken. They wanted to just be their age and for it all just to be normal, but their relationships from then on would change. It was as if this gang of neighborhood kids had all come of age in an instant. They knew of something that they should still have been beyond their knowing. Their disaster was not unfamiliar to John. Those of us who grew up in Mission Hills in those years, we mostly were all messed up. The question was, in what way? Most of our stories remain guarded within the walls of our homes. But at this late date, there's little point in keeping secrets. Certainly not before God. It's his book, after all. And if perhaps you believe in such things, it's always been open. Growing up, John's dad had taught at the University of San Diego, a local Catholic university. Among other things, he taught a class on the American family. And he worked in a conciliation court for the city. And he'd been a therapist. And he was also a drinker, a big drinker. Like beyond drinking. His partner in his therapeutic practice was a polyamorous, defrocked priest turned poet named James Kavanaugh, who promoted orgy sex therapy for struggling couples. It was the 70s, and Kavanaugh was a swinger. John's mother had been born an O'Dowd. Until the end of her days, she'd pray every night. A plastic crucifix hung in the hall, which might suggest they were practicing Catholics, but not practicing enough. John's parents divorced when John was 3. His dad had always wanted to be more than he was, while his mom was always practical and hard-headed. And so, one day, John's dad up and left, hoping to find that person, perhaps, who he so badly wanted to become.
When you burnt your hair.
Listening to The Mountain, an Adoration in a Multitude of Parts. And this is your host, Andrew Lewis. I am so glad to be sitting here live with you, mistakes and all, as I learn how to operate this board. John had a sister, Patty, whose brain had been damaged, so that though she lived for decades, she'd never be older than a child of five. John had a brother, Bob, who saw demons, and an older sister, Mary, who taught Spanish and made art, and an older brother, Tom, who started a company that installed tile. All of John's siblings had gone to Catholic schools, but it fell away before John was old enough to go. When the time came for Patty to be confirmed into the Holy Faith, the nuns had scolded her because it was beyond her ability to learn the catechism. Which begs, what happens to the immortal soul of the swallow, or of the disabled child, the one who will never be able to comprehend the word. If there were to be a Christ, for whom would he reserve his compassion? Perhaps for Helen. Helen was left alone to raise 5 kids. In the early 1970s, she worked for Snack Rack, filling the snack machines at city schools. She was scared and desperate. She thought at times of ending her own life and taking her children, Bob and Patty, with her. But she didn't. She kept on. And she eventually signed on with the Department of Education and got to be the person who did the scheduling for the 6th grade camps. For John, the world was a scary place. When he was 12, he squirmed his way into a crawl space beneath his house, and he took whatever pills he could find, and he hoped that he would die there. It was only because of a neighbor who noticed him missing and found him that he didn't. When older, he was quick for a thrill. He would dive off cliffs into raging surf in La Jolla. He wore boots to protect his feet when he hit the water. 5, 10, 15 times, he jumped off the Glen A. Rick Bridge that crossed Mission Bay. From his earliest years, John had loved to draw. It was about all that he knew. His teachers sometimes allowed him to sit out assignments and to just doodle. They just didn't know what to do with him. After graduating from high school, most of his friends went off to college, but not John. In those years, in his early 20s, his dad was dying of lung cancer, and so John retreated to be with him in a 1960 stucco ranch house in Hemet. The rooms darkened from the windows covered in reflective mylar coating. John would sit on the floor of his dad's living room, and he watched TV, and he chain-smoked, and he sculpted, and he whittled while his father died. Out of tin cans and brass and wood, he would later fashion a burial altar for his father's ashes. He muddled about and knew enough to know that he was being left behind. And so he got himself back to school, and he got a degree in fine art at San Diego State. He found a mentor. Her name was Trina, and she schooled him in realism. She pushed him to paint accurately and to develop his technique. He studied intensively the anatomy of people and animals and the morphology of plants. John was tall and rail thin and magnetic. People wanted to be around him. After graduating from State, he moved out of the main house and into his mother's garage, which he turned into a studio. He gutted the small structure and recruited his friends to help him add a second story. He installed a wall of salvaged windows. From his brother Tom, he scavenged lots of tiles left over from jobs, and he tiled the garage floor in mismatched pieces of limestone and clay glazed in burnt orange and cobalt blue and sienna yellow. Together, he and his friends hung sheetrock and floated stucco on the exterior, and he painted the stucco gray. The top floor became his studio, and the driveway an outdoor atelier. Though he didn't know it, it would be there in the future where he would cure wood salvaged from the canyons, and he would use it for carving. In a portable kiln, he fired porcelain. He gained a command of physiology and musculature. He got himself into art school in Long Beach. There he pulled back and roughened his technique, seeking, I guess, a balance between the precise and the gestural. He made images that were emotive and less literal, and yet he was skilled enough to make near-perfect replicas of things in all their original physical beauty. If you look at the pieces from those years, you can see John reaching more deeply, more confidently. The art department had a press, and he learned to make large prints. At his graduation, he mounted a show and afterwards gave all the pieces away to his friends. A plane descending and strafing a burning city, the ventricles of a heart on a torn and tangled background. After that debut moment, John's future felt clear to him. He would continue working, he'd mount successive shows, he'd secure commissions. It was about that time that we ourselves had moved back to San Diego and our fresh apartment perch in Golden Hill. We would see John regularly, visiting him at his garage studio, or he'd make his way over for beers on our deck. He was good. He knew that. He was good enough that he could get paid doing this. Good enough that perhaps he could make a name for himself. We could all feel the vainglory of our 20s, how we feel when we truly believe that the world will be ours and we are intoxicated by the unknown, by the joy and excitement as we approach the precipice of our own becoming.
Cricket song, we were damn sure about it. And love was a shape in the slippery light, a flame on a moth-lit moon this night. We were damn sure about it. Muscle on bone, we were damn sure about it. And love was a half-blurred poem we wrote, the creak in the moan of the hardwood floor. Damn sure about it. We were damn sure about it. We were damn sure about it. We were damn, damn sure. Staring at the beaks on the bird face men. Now you're sitting in the kitchen with someone else, stacking up peels of your clementines. Oh,
Cows thanks Dr. Robert Shulman for his support. Dr. Shulman is board certified in a broad spectrum of physical and integrative medicines, as well as prolotherapy. His offices are located at 95 Montgomery Drive in Santa Rosa. You can find out more at westcountyintegrativemedicine.com.
Cows thanks North Coast Solar for their ongoing support. North Coast Solar has been supplying residential and commercial businesses with solar power since 1984. Their website, ncsr.com, contains information about how to improve energy reliability. They can be reached at 707-575-3999. North Coast Solar is proud to sponsor Uncle Charlie's Jukebox here on Cows every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Pacific.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. And this is your host, Andrew Lewis. As we continue with this serialized story, John's mentor Trina at San Diego State had received a commission to complete a sculpture of Elizabeth Seton to be installed at the entrance of the Church of St. Elizabeth Seton in the town of Carlsbad, just north of San Diego. The church was young yet, certainly within the 2,000-year span of ecclesiastic history. The parish had been established in 1976, the year after Elizabeth Seton had been canonized. In the beginning, masses were celebrated at the La Costa Resort and Spa, and outside storefronts, and even in the homes of parishioners. In 1979, the parish purchased a conference center where they would hold services for the next two decades. In the early 1990s, however, Father Donald Coleman, Father Don as he was known, was hired on as pastor, and he was tasked with the completion of the church. Father Don was looking for some decoration in a small chapel antechamber where there were some wall surfaces that needed to be painted. Trina suggested to John that he should approach Father Don, and she arranged for a meeting. Their conversation that day in his church office would not be without consequence. That day they sat together, John, a 20-something kid, and Father Don, balding, hair trimmed close to his skull. A short white beard, more a line of frost from his sideburns to his chin. He wore silver wire-rimmed glasses and possessed an older solemnity. Father Don explained that he wanted something to look at when he was doing Mass in what at that time was known as the Daily Chapel. He escorted John into the room. It was perhaps 60 feet in length, 40 feet wide, stained glass window and a pulpit at one end. The side walls were adorned with ceramic tiles depicting the Stations of the Cross. And opposite from the pulpit, a white proscenium arch, and at the far end, a low white wall. All the walls were neutral white. Fluorescent lighting, metal ADA handrails, rows of chairs that one might find in a hotel banquet hall. There, in this austere place, Father Don would conduct the rites of the daily Mass, and on those days, he would stare toward the blank arch. He wanted something pleasing to look at. He told John that he could do as he wished. John had come from a background in printmaking. He was confident in that. To him, the surfaces of the back wall seemed vast. He could make some prints, he thought, but even they would have been swallowed up by the space. He didn't want them hanging as adornment, but instead inset into the wall as if they were part of the very fabric of the church, which meant he would have to build something out so that he could inset the prints. And it would look silly to do something on the far wall but have them crowned by the black proscenium. John found the industrial white oppressive. He imagined the patina that one might encounter in an old Italian church, and adorned with something, but he wasn't sure what. He imagined animals, enormous winged creatures on the wall. And then there was the matter of geography. Carlsbad was 40 miles north. He couldn't be going up there every day, and he couldn't be putting the chapel out of commission for months. His solution would have to be something that he could work on at home in the garage behind his mother's house. Perhaps he could also work out of his girlfriend's studio up in Signal Hill in Long Beach. That afternoon, standing in the barren chapel with Father Don, John didn't know at all what was to come. He asked the father for a few days and said he would get back to him. As he left, he took from the church a stack of catalogs from the East Coast and from Italy, and from which you could order mass-produced church art. And then he drove, excited and curious, and it might be fair to say daunted, the long way back to San Diego.
Spain, sleep out with the dogs, find some empty castle and put my jacket on a cross. The mice are in the fields and the ghosts are in the towers. Little wind, I'm with you in the roadside flowers. I might go to town, drink myself away, find some singing bird and try to step inside her cage. But I might go to waste and I might be a coward. But little wind, I'm with you in the roadside flowers. And I wish that I had stayed in that river house with you, pulled away the weeds and let the wild roses bloom. All the hanging plums one day will go sour. Little wind, I'm with you in the roadside flowers. Don't you want to fly with the Highland birds? Don't you want to plan in the calendar? Maybe it's my fault and maybe it's my power. Little wind, I'm with you in the roadside flowers.
Back home, John pored over the catalogs of church art. Cookie-cutter resin statues of the Virgin Mary fetched $5,000 or $10,000 or $15,000. And this was basically for church junk. Statues of St. Peter, eyes cast heavenward toward his maker. Pages and pages of stuff milled out to clutter churches and houses and chapels with religious landfill. At best, the things felt drained of mystery. At worst, it was pretty goofy stuff. So John was compelled to do something different, do something that would say something beyond what could be purchased in a catalog. And he wanted to go back, way back, perhaps to the time of the early Christian art, a time when the rock of the medieval church did not even exist as an image. The images and forms that would later be iconic had not yet evolved. John wanted to convey that rawness and innocence. So the first problem was the walls themselves. John decided that he would make his own surfaces that he could work on in his garage and that he could color and adorn as he liked. As with the Grünwald altarpiece, he would mount his prints on floating panels. As for the prints, he would do scenes from the life of Christ. He'd always liked the stories in the Gospels, the simplicity, not so much the godliness as the humanity. A child born in the darkness, a man standing scared, expectant, perhaps in wonder in the lapping water, a dark night alone. He could do these, but then he would need something in the center, an icon of sorts that would draw the eye. John pulled books from the San Diego State University Library. He was already familiar with Babylonian and pre-Christian religious art, how things were represented before the current church gained its structure. He wanted the simpler, more original forms. And he wanted the animistic aspects, the coursing of life that was at the foundation of all things. He looked at hundreds of images, the Byzantines, the Romanesque and Gothic and Reformation and Counter-Reformation images, wanting to make sure that he wasn't making any big mistakes. He wanted to know the choices others had made and tried to unpack why they had done what they had done. John made a super basic sketch of the arch and the wall, where the scenes would go, and he chose the scenes that he would portray. On the arch, he would put representations of each of the Gospels. He was drawn to the Ghiberti doors and the baptistry in Florence, and there were woodcuts. One in particular, of a lion as a surrogate for St. Mark. Also a woodcut of the four apostles and the bull representing St. Luke. He decided that on the proscenium he would portray animals instead of men. And the animals, they would have wings. And then there was the center, the apex of the church that he needed to contend with. Typically, that spot would be filled with the Pentocrator, an image of Christ, the King and Redeemer. Traditionally, he sits holding the book, the other hand raised, bestowing a blessing. But John didn't want this. Why? Well, because perhaps because we can no longer see that image. We have seen it so many times that we no longer can even perceive it. We can't see it for what it is. We can't see the magnitude that it represents. We can only see our memory of it from all the other times we've seen it. So John wanted something new, something greater, perhaps more simple, stylized, and elemental. John made visual notes from Gothic wooden sculptures. He was drawn to any animal depiction that appeared realistic. Oftentimes, the medieval and Renaissance images were not. Sometimes, the artist was halfway making it up, as if the person had never seen the real creature, so he had to draw from imagination. John wanted his animals to not be this way, not representations at all, but to possess the fire and entity and fullness of the real. And he was a bit scared. The truth was, John hadn't done much painting, and most of what he'd done had been in acrylic. But there was the lamb and the bull. These things. He knew these things, and perhaps in them he could be secure. After a couple weeks, John scheduled a meeting with Father Don. They met again in his small office. John presented the sketches of the images and the general layout on the walls. Father Don barely reviewed them. "How much do you want?" he asked. John said it would cost 15 grand. "Sure," Father Don said. And that was it. And that was it. John was in his late 20s. And there he was. He'd been commissioned to adorn a church. And he'd just been promised $15,000 to do it. He was a real artist now, driving back home along the coast on that long road from Carlsbad to Mission Hills. He was soaring higher than he had ever been before. You have been listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. And thank you for supporting live radio and supporting The Mountain as we get our sea legs on this board. Local radio is a gift. Thank you. Special shout out to KOWS LP Occidental 92.5 for providing community radio to West Sonoma County and the universe. Also encourage all listeners to support your community. Shop local, buy local, dine local. If you go to a big box store, only 11 to 15 cents of each dollar spent returns to our community. When you shop locally, 47 to 55 cents of each dollar returns to our community. So let's invest in ourselves. A few special shout outs. First to the Living Room Life Center, located at 1335 North Dutton Avenue in Santa Rosa. Their mission is to ease adversity and promote stability, dignity, and self-reliance for women and children who are homeless or at risk of homelessness in Sonoma County. The primary emphasis is to aid with housing, food, education, and services for women and their children. For more information about the program, please call 707-579-0138 or visit them online at thelivingroomsc.org. Also, especially in this time, for those in our community in need of nutritious food, you are invited to the St. Philip Rural Food Distribution. They provide fresh, local eggs, fresh produce, fresh milk, cheeses, meats, and fish, bread, soups, and canned goods. Food distribution is held at the Occidental Parish Hall on the second Tuesday of the month from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. The next distribution is going to be on December 9th. With that, today's songs are Why May I Not Go Out and Climb the Trees by Daniel Norgren, So Much Wine by the Handsome Family, and sung in this instance by Phoebe Bridger. Thanks to all of them for their various renditions. Damn Sure by Laura Gibson, Little Wind by Haley Hendricks, that's with a KX for those who want to look it up, and Learning to Fly by Tom Petty, performed live on June 16th, 2006 at the Bonnaroo Music Festival. And I'll be sending you out with On the Attack by The Law and Longhorn Slim. And I might even put in a little bit of O.C. Elliott there. We'll see. Special thanks to the Blue Dot Sessions for the background loop, The Telling, from their 2017 album, Marisala. And by all means, if you enjoyed the listen and it makes your world a little bigger, consider sharing with your friends. You can Google The Mountain and Adoration in a Multitude of Parts to find the Substack, or you can go to the KOWS website and look at the archive to stream preceding episodes of The Mountain so you can get all caught up. And again, thanks for your patience as this develops and we collectively figure things out. With that, please have a great day or a good night wherever you are.
So long to be the measure of the man I hoped I would be. I take a step forward, I take two steps back. I can't help but be bored, unless I'm on the attack. and attacking's alright. We were up on the hill where the blueberries grow, with time to kill. I started to fall, nigga. Hard to breathe, nigga. Hard to relax. It's hard to face yourself when you're still busy looking back. And attacking's alright.
Swallow this you. can't go back. I cannot go home. My younger days are over. Looking back, how I've flown so far away from that home. How from the
This is KOWSLP Occidental 92.5, serving Santa Rosa and West Sonoma County for 18 years, streaming to the world at KOWSFM.com from our studios in Santa Rosa. Visit our website to listen, donate, or volunteer. You can also download the Radio Rethink streaming app from the App Store. Our email address is KOWS@sonic.net. You can also give us a like on Facebook at facebook.com/KOWS.FM. And you have been listening to The Mountain, an Adoration in a Multitude of Parts with your host, Andrew Lewis. This is a streaming, serialized, multi-part story. If you want to catch up on previous episodes, you can go to the KOWS website and look at archive shows, or you can go to the Mountain and Adoration Substack and find links there as well. Hope you're well, and hope you have a great weekend and a wonderful life. Thank you.